Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Getting Stuff Done in Higher Ed. I'm Fritz Vandover, and I'm joined, as always, by Kelvin Bentley and Kevin Schreiner. Kevin's wearing a Cubs logo, so I will be ignoring him and be slightly mean today. So today we're joined by Dr. Kendim Gabak, who's a friend of mine and a former colleague, but still a friend forever after experiencing COVID in higher ed together. So we're so thrilled to have you, Kendim, today to talk about your role in higher ed, where you are, what you're doing, your path, and all the things that we'll get into. So welcome, and let's get going. So tell us where you are right now and the role you're in, and then we'll just organically start to throw some questions around and let it go.
Yeah, thanks, Fritz, Kevin, and Kelvin for, you know, inviting me as your second guest speaker. So at MCAT, I work as a senior director for the Department of Teaching Learning Excellence. It's housed under the area of academic affairs. We're a small arts and design college. And at MCAT, my work has largely been in the area of kind of like moving past the dichotomy of like this online versus in-person. You know, these distinctions have largely dissolved, right, since the pandemic. And really engaging faculty with, you know, dialogues and topics that matter to them. So, for example, at MCAT, a large population of our faculty are adjunct faculty. So it's been very challenging to even engage with them, right? How do we engage with them? How do we incentivize them? So in my department, instead of thinking about training as a cohort-based model, as we generally do, right, when you think about like online trainings, we started building toolkits, and think about toolkits as like this mini lesson packed. You know, you can kind of like go in and like build your own lesson, do your own kind of, so you kind of like build like mini competencies, and then there's something for you to practice in your Canvas course. And I think the one of the benefits, right, of the pandemic is, you know, somehow everyone has pretty much come up to speed with being able to use a learning management system, or the ability to, you know, navigate with some digital tool, you know, to teach online, right? Or like facilitate virtual learning, whatever that means, right? But there's at least some understanding based on, you know, where we were before. So I think in our roles, that's what we've been more effective at is, you know, listening in. I sit, you know, in my own role, I'm able, and I think also the ability of being a smaller college, you know, there's more access to be able to sit in on a variety of committees, right? I'm part of the curriculum committee. I'm part of the academic cabinet committee, where I listen in, you know, to the needs from department chairs, program directors, the registrar's office, from the director of the learning center, from people from student affairs, right? So I think in my role, it's, I think, a lot of like listening in and then bringing it back to my team and being like, okay, this is a teaching and learning problem. This is seems to be a mental health issue, but then let's turn it into a little toolkit. Let's do a little bit of like almost like education programming, but then like, how do you kind of infuse and diffuse some of these ideas, right?
Yeah.
So with faculty, that's been a very effective, doing this toolkit-centered way of addressing their professional development needs.
Kendim, I'm sorry. So before we go too much further down, can you just describe your college? Like you said, you're small. Like what's your size? Just so
700.
Have an idea of like the type of environment that you're referring to.
Yeah, it's a small arts and design college. So it's about 800 undergraduate students, right? We have about five graduate programs, online programs, but we have very robust online programs. And this was even prior to the pandemic, where there were a number of, we have a master's in creative leadership, we have a master's in sustainable design program. And all of these programs are run fully online. Faculty are from all over the world, all over, I'm saying the United States. We have students from all over. And so it's how do we still sustain learning in these programs, innovate these programs, right? And also provide the level of professional development for these faculty who do feel a level of disenfranchisement because you're not part of the faculty body, right? But you still yeah. need some level of training. So there's a little bit of, those are some of the gaps that I have seen when I went working at MGAD in terms of like, how do we address faculty development? And another thing that we just flushed out this fall is a pathway programming. So it's these certificate courses to incentivize faculty to, so instead of, because, hey, money is low, right? We can't pay people anymore. I think in every institution you go, gone are the days of like paying someone $5,000 to, you know, build an online course, right? And so now we're thinking about like, well, how do we kind of like flip it and be like, well, you're constantly learning. And I think that's what our department is also trying to, in a way, emulate the culture of appreciating teaching as a practice, right? As a continuous practice. And so when we do that, how do we kind of, then you kind of shift and you see your own personal development as, well, I'm not going to be taking this class because I'm getting paid, but I'm doing it for my own learning. So our Pathways program that we just piloted this fall is the neurodiversity in higher education. And the intention is to slowly spark an interest, but also build an awareness in cultivating neuro-inclusive teaching in our campus. And this was kind of, in a way, pushed because in our own college strategic plan, radical accessibility is one of like the main goals of, you know, what the college wants to be. And so, you know, in our own department, we're like, well, what does that mean, right, as an arts and design college? So I think some of the conversations that we do have is like by bringing awareness of like neurodiversity, inclusive teaching and learning, universal design for learning methods. I'm saying the list goes on and on, but essentially like frameworks built on the pedagogy of care.
This is really interesting, Ken, in that you have this juxtaposition of small scale and large scale. You have a small student population, smaller than so many institutions in the US. You said about 800 undergraduate students. I'm assuming there's not 800 graduate students, but never know. I mean, I don't know what your head count is totally, but then you have this giant population of other instructors who are in the US or beyond teaching the program. So you have this, not many places have that kind of challenge. Usually small scale equals small scale staff and students, and you can create relationships. So how are you bridging, at least on the large scale side, on the faculty and instructor side, how do you, because one of my questions is going to be is, you know, a smaller institution, how much technology do you use to interact with people? But I think I've answered my own question. You have this giant scale to deal with. So tell us how you're bridging that to make connections and move forward with this huge population of instructors.
You mean to say, how do we engage these groups of instructors with their learning?
And just, you know, like you said, how do you incentivize? And you lead a team of instructional designers and others. And how big is your team?
So we are, again, small scale, right? So I have an instructional consultant. I have a learning designer. And then a assistant director who does ed tech, like all of the ed tech, like think of like someone who will be all the Canvas learning management. But essentially we work more like a team in terms of, so we'll have projects. So if you think about like initiatives in our department, like what does that look like, right? So we do course development support. So we still do like the general online course development. A number of courses are still converting into online courses. There's interest to develop new online courses too. So we continuously support that, I'm saying that market, right? And now there's also this growing market of certificate courses. So like the certificate programming is a booming market. And so we are seeing, and so what does that mean for our department is we're building a lot of resources centered around like adult education, How do you, you know, I'm saying, how do you design a lesson for an adult learner, right? Because a lot of certificate courses is adult learners who are coming and re-upskilling, you know, to make their skill sets relevant for the job market, right, of today. So it's, again, educating our faculty, right, on that, like the learner profile. I recently published a toolkit, again, another, think about a toolkit as a newsletter, and I can email you some of these artifacts that we have from our department. But essentially, it's just this summarized, less academic sounding artifact, right? But essentially, the toolkit was like showing up in class, and it was like a self-reflection that invites faculty to be like, well, when we talk about our learner is not a monolith, right? They're, you know, so I open up our whole MCAD student population and we look at up our student population, 50% of them are Bell Grant recipients. So let's look up who Bell Grant recipients are, right? And as we talk about and we disaggregate, right, our student profile, we learn that our needs, right, the backgrounds of our students are completely misaligned with their needs. And then so then there's an empathic understanding that's also then built for the instructor, right? To see that, hey, this learner is not just like this learner, right? The student. And I think this is what my passion has always been when it comes to like with the faculty, or when we use this word, the teacher, right? Well, who is this teacher, right? Like, let's personalize it. Let's humanize that person, right? Or when we say the staff, right? I think like it loses the human when we kind of use and box people in these frames. And so like even the students. So I think like when we kind of like really deconstruct some of these ideas, then there's also some level of empathy that's built in to the process of lesson design, or also then in the selection of various education technologies, right, for the learning.
So, Kingdom, can you talk a little bit about how you're when you said 50% of your students are Pell Grant, you have 800 students, 800 students, 400 of them are Pell Grant, which probably means they're also first gen, by and large, maybe. Yep. And so with your toolkits, because I'm just really intrigued by this, because it's like a very strong background of mine as well, is thinking about underrepresented students in higher ed.
Yes. Yeah.
How, because it's an alignment between academic affairs and student affairs a little bit.
So right? We are all in tandem. Yeah. So that's the thing. Yeah. All of these higher education issues cannot be resolved in a silo, right? That's why it requires us to kind of like work in teams. And I'm saying it's just problem solving, right? With just like new problems that our society has. And every time there'll be new problems, right? It's just the way life goes. So going back to let's reiterate your question. What did you just ask?
Yeah, so I'm just kind of interested in how
cross-generation,
how you're blending really the academic affairs through instructional design and student affairs into I just think about higher ed in general. Those are siloed worlds where...
Absolutely. So I'll give you a good example of what's happening at MCAD. So at MCAD, we have a foundations program that's run. And so in the foundations program, 2 years ago, we introduced a first-year experience. It's a one-credit course. And again, it's just based off the high-impact learning practices by George Kuh, right? And I think it's highly informed a number of this first-year program. I think even at the U, there was one... Fritz, I think there's still one, right? First year experience, first year writing, similar kind of programming. So this programming has been super like helpful in terms of retention of first generation students. As even like recently, our 10-day stats showed, you know, a lot of these efforts point towards the retention, I'm saying, you know, and persistence of these groups of students, right? So why? Because a lot of these resources are esoteric, right? I'm saying going to school is a privilege. Understanding, you know, which resources, who to go and talk to, how to advocate for yourself, right? Like I, before I was in MCAD, I was back at the U actually running as a director for the Multicultural Center, kind of working with historically marginalized groups, like, and essentially a lot of topics around this. And it's the same issues, right? It's students, they don't know the resources because it was not given to them. And the other thing is most of them, it's not in our cultures also to advocate for yourselves, right? To ask the questions. And so in the first year experience courses, there are lessons specifically designed to make the student aware of campus resources. Where our department comes in is we build a lot of learner guides. We work with student affairs. We work with the learning center. We work with the counselors, you know. So we listen in and we kind of look, kind of capture what are some of the students' needs, what are the pressure points, right? And then we try to address this in the toolkits and try to make it like bite-sized, you know, so it's easy for then faculty to be able to, because for them it's like, tell me what to do, right? A student's having a mental event in the classroom, tell me what to do. Three-part list, well, these are the three. And when you prepare people with what to do, then eventually slowly, I think awareness, right? And then slowly then you get into a culture of inclusive teaching.
So I want to pause for a second and ask, what brought you here? You know, you have entree and you've created entree into a lot of spaces from your role and where you are at MCED. And it's fascinating to me, you know, and I think people who are in their careers and wanting to broaden them or where they, you know, their impact, you have a high impact role. You're faculty affairs, you're everywhere, it seems. And so what did you assemble? What kind of skills and expertise did you assemble to get to where you are?
That's a really good question. I think I've been lucky in terms of being able to, you know, meet, and I think this harkens back to, I think that Angela Duckworth's book, Grit, right? Is it's like sometimes you just end up meeting certain people in your lives that maybe provide a certain insight, a certain access, you know, to talk to this or, you know, don't jump off the cliff. Like, you know, you can still finish your PhD. Like, I'm like, so many times I wanted to like quit grad school, right? Yeah. And like, you always have, and I can name so many people, right? Like in my life, right? Like who've kind of helped me, right? Get there. So I think having a very strong resilience network is key. I think being able to cultivate a sense of humility in your own thinking in terms of like, accept, you know, that like you don't know everything, you know, and then the curiosity to learn and the willingness to kind of listen to ideas that might be uncomfortable, right? And I think that is a skill probably that I kind of started getting good at was because even in my own graduate research work, I had to work with tribal populations in Papua New Guinea, negotiating for female teachers to get access to do design workshops, you know, doing a lot of like gender-based violence work in Nepal, designing curriculum. So
I'm sorry, like you've like that just like you just went like in a totally different direction with the things that you're doing or have done. How did you get into that to begin with?
Well, my PhD was I would say the ethos of my work has always been interested in working with marginalized groups. And even
in your PhD's in instructional systems, if I'm remembering correctly, grounded it in that.
Yeah. So even my master's thesis, I worked with like the digital divide, working with bringing digital storytelling into like rural schools in Bhutan. So I've always been interested in ideas of equity and understanding justice in that lens, and more so in kind of operationalizing that in the area of now education. So how do I do that? I think now, like, I think I use a lot of like my knowledge from my own graduate school. I'm deeply interested in neuroscience and, you know, cognitive psychology. So I bring a lot of like some of that understanding in my own, you know, practice. But yeah, I think that's what drives me in terms of like my passion. And I think it harkens back to like, well, what interests you, right? And I think that's what interests me, and like what keeps me motivated and interested to also work at MGAD is the people. The people deeply care about working at MGAD, and I've never seen this in any other institution. And I think it's because everyone who works there is an artist or a creative. Like in my department, my assistant director is a comic, and he's a very good comic artist. Then my consultant, she's a illustrator. So like everyone has, and she sews. So everyone has their creative space. Mm. And if you all live in the Twin Cities, if you ever come to the Twin Cities, please come to MCAD, visit us. It's a beautiful campus with art everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, isn't it connected directly physically to the Minneapolis Institute of Art?
Which yeah, it's also connected to the MIA. And so it's just simmering ground of like criticality and like creativity. And I think that's what we need, right? Like going back to like, so now another thing that we are doing a little bit more carefully is intentionally thinking about education programming related to Gen AI. So as you can see, a lot of institutions are either jumping deep dive, right? Like drinking the Kool-Aid or not drinking the Kool-Aid. And I think also in a space of, I don't really think it's a to be or not to be. I think it's more of a space of like knowing what AI is. And for artists and designers, I think there is an urgency, you know, to do AI literacy, but do AI literacy in their terms.
Yeah, there's an ethics component.
Absolutely. There's an ethical component. There's a moral component. And there, like I'm saying, if you think about creativity, and as a creative or a designer, like the creative process involves a primary generator, right? And a lot of artists these days, if you're only utilizing Gen AI to generate your art, you're not going to be innovating, or you're not going to be creating or developing your own unique form, right?
Yeah. So you're taking a cooked down version of every other form.
Oh, yeah, it's so absurd. So I think there's also this level of absurdity. But I think there's also this need for like agentic awareness that is needed for artists and designers, and because there's also this resistance. So it's very challenging at MCAD right now because there is this cultural resistance, like we don't want to use AI, right? Because we are an artist. So there is this direct cultural resistance. But then on our end, right, like as educators, there's also this ethical obligation to do AI literacy because it is a disruptive technology, right? And it is going to change everyone's lives. We just don't know how, right? So
this is really interesting because to me, you know, I bring a critical lens to a lot of things. And even though I've worked in, like most of us here, all of us here, we've worked in academic technologies one way or another for decades. Mm-hmm. But to me, Gen AI and AI in general, you can't, and I've said this in other episodes, I think, to me, I don't know how you use a tool like that to bypass knowledge and expertise. Because if you're faking it, it's pretty darn clear. Whether you're faking it in your work, it's usually pretty clear. And I know this is different from arts, but writing, synthesizing things. You know, if someone says, okay, I need you to invoke this expertise on whatever, engineering or some field that you have to have expertise, you know, eventually you're going to fall flat and it's going to be bad, whether it's in a presentation for your degree or to a job interview, or you somehow get the job and then you're asked to produce and you're held painfully accountable. And in the arts world, I think that it seems to be more so, you know, that it's all about, you have to struggle with creating something in an artistic space. So, you know, to use it to amplify what you do is one thing. Like, you know, the arts have used adopted technologies on the way, you know, Photoshop to create things, but to me, a lot of them, you're still looking at a blank space. You have to take control of a blank space, a blank sheet of music, and you got to create something, or a blank canvas or a blank slab of marble. So to me, like, how do you buy? You can't really easily bypass it. You still have to know how to create something.
Correct. And I think context matters, right? So they are faculty, I would say. And I think it depends on the fields or the creative fields, right? So if you talk about illustration, Gen AI has already been infused. It's been infused for the last decade or so, right? Or AI tools have already been infused, right? If you look at Photoshop, like Firefly, a number of like these tick, 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 they already have like some AI component, right? So the reality is, I think no one's saying it, but I don't care. I'm going to say it out loud. I don't think people really know, in terms of like quantified fact, how much stuff of yours in terms of ownership is really kind of is there once you kind of like upload your stuff, right? Or if you get it back and then you're now using it to kind of like generate your art, like how much of it is then the
optimized.
So I think that becomes very messy.
Yeah.
And so I think it can be useful, for example, if the artist is able to very carefully, and I think this is like the level of expertise that you develop, right? So I would not recommend a novice artist, right, in training, who has not developed ideas of form, functionality, I'm saying the formal techniques, right, yeah, of understanding art, to use that, because they might, you know. But I think like when you have a little bit of level of like maybe some level of like mid-level, you are able to understand it. But now you're using it to maybe critique or to see what happens, or to, I'm saying, there might be benefits for learning there. And I think there are some instructors who are doing or using it in that kind of space, right, or in that context. But it's very messy, right? And I think it really depends who you're asking to. And it's a spectrum of responses, and it's very polarized responses too. Like, so for example, at MGAD, if you ask someone who's highly entrenched in like a very traditional art discipline, it's a very emotional reaction towards AI about it's bad, right? The environment, and then you're not having any dialogue, okay? And then in the other spectrum, then you have a field where there are like some level of entrepreneurship, there is some level of creativity going on, and they are using, for example, Gen AI to engage with native populations in, you know, Greenland, you know, and then so it also empowers these populations who've never been able to, like, you know, share their languages now, but using AI, right? So I'm saying AI can also be used as a tool to empower certain groups. So it's so,
yes.
So, you know, it's like, it's how you frame it. I think it's the framing, yeah, and context is, it's very important when we talk about Gen AI. Right. So I think in the area of academic integrity and plagiarism, that level of nuance, I think, should be provided by like academic affairs, what I'm saying, you know, like within the syllabus, or because faculty need this. Like, I think there needs to be some clarity of you know, what is that, right? And so some level of, some kind of policy needs to be provided for, you know, how Gen AI is going to be used in the classroom. But students apparently are, students already using it.
Yeah.
So how do you all evaluate, like, I just think about software, and you're in an online program teaching art. Clearly there's a lot of, I'm developing all this on my own and submitting this as an assignment. But do you, are you all evaluating the software? Like, you brought up Photoshop, right? And I'm a huge Photoshop person as well, because I love to get rid of the people that are in my photos and print a, you know, and display a nice, clean, here's the shot with nobody in it, right? But you can take that to extremes. Yeah. So how are you thinking, how does your team help faculty? So how do you guide those conversations as to what you should be using and how to use that, and the ramifications that, you know, a student potentially could, like, take a photo, but then enhance it, you know, to where it's not authentic to what they did.
Yeah. So the beauty is, again, we work at MCAT. So we have, like, illustrators, and we have a print shop, and we have the media center. So the media center essentially has the subscription and licenses for all of our Adobe Photo Suite. So because Adobe Suite, such as Photoshop, Illustrator, and because all of our students have a component of illustration as part of, like, their foundational curriculum, right? It's part of, like, their tuition that's baked in. So the media center handles all of, like, the installations into their MacBook, and every student who comes to MCAT gets a MacBook.
Wow.
So a Mac that has all of that installed. So the media center, they're very good with providing student support, faculty support, staff support for the tools. Our department provides the instructional level of support. So let's say if they want to run certain level of meeting using these tools, then we provide, like, directions, like, in terms of, like, pedagogical, you know, resources, FERPA considerations, and any other, like, considerations that they need to have. But generally, it's more of you do it on your own approach, you know. So we'll provide, like, guides, you know, toolkits that they will go in and be able to.
Wow. So does MCAT have an enterprise AI tool? You know, so for example, the University of Minnesota just about a month or two ago implemented Gemini across the whole system. So it's, you know, we all have access, and we're a Google campus anyway, so it makes sense. But now we all have access. It's, you know, it's walled off. There's no, it's, we're not training their, you know, we're not training their model. So it's our own closed ecosystem that passes all the security tests. But because of MCAT as a creative or institution fostering creativity, the arts, et cetera, design, do you all have one? Other than, say, the things that are baked into tools like Illustrator and Photoshop and other tools that are licensed, but because I can see how there wouldn't be.
No, we are very, and I think because of that, the careful consideration of agentic awareness and the creativity, it's very careful. So, like, even the use of these tools, it's like our graphics design program, or it's very specific illustration programs that use these, right? But then in general, I would say positioning on Gen AI is more neutral and careful in terms of, like, let's kind of approach it as, like, from this literacy place, right, of, like, criticality, understanding, like, you know, your own agency as an artist, addressing all of these concerns, like, of authorship, right? Like, understanding all what authorship looks like. But it's not a full dive. Like, let's use Gemini and upload a bunch of our artwork. I don't think that's going to happen at MCAT.
Is MCAT, is there a strong and current tradition, strong tradition and current state of faculty governance? So do faculty have a say in this, where
So
it's not a top-down institution where you're saying, look, we're going to use Gen AI or not in the curriculum, et cetera. There's a faculty
government. We have a faculty senate, yeah. So we have a faculty senate, and we liaise some of these ideas in terms of, like, I think these are just like collective tensions or questions that most college campuses are probably grappling with, right? It's like to be or not to be, and like some are being and some are not being. But I think like we are in a space of like, we want to be, but we want to be in our own terms, right? And I think it's okay to say that. And so our faculty are also artists, right? So there's a certain cultural resistance towards Gen AI, like as a traditional artist, right? So it's... I think it'll be a series of conversations. My department is leading some of these initiatives to, I would say, start some of these courageous conversations.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
You know, but it's a series of conversations that we are all having. I'm curious myself, right? Is it's like, hey, like it's affecting all of our fields. What does it mean for us and, you know, for students, right?
So here's a question I think a lot of higher ed is grappling with right now. I know we are at the University of Minnesota. How do you and your team build expertise, knowledge, competency, so that you can then put that through the lens of your backgrounds, your expertise, your knowledge, and then bring that to the MCAD faculty, instructors, students, to help them develop their competencies too?
So basically, it's like, how do you feed yourself so you can keep feeding them?
Yeah.
Well, I think we just had that that conversation a while back, right? Money is low. Money.
Yes.
So I think in the area of professional development, same for us. Like, I haven't gone to a professional conference, like aside from like a local one, in like a very long time, right? But there's definitely, like, I think we've shifted the ways of we are looking at professional development. Like in my own department, every month we have a club called the Learning Club. And so every member kind of leads a topic of their own interest. And it's been very successful for a year. We've been doing this. And so that's how some of us, we keep up with like up and coming topics. And there's also some interest for the individual member to kind of like learn about it, build their own kind of like competency, and then teach others. So last week, for example, Alex, who I mentioned as the artist, right? So he has an MFA. So he was, he introduced us to various critique methods. And so we were critiquing a whole art piece, and it was so amazing. And I was just kind of like, so we do a number of these things, right? I try to go to like one or two conferences locally, bring back some of that information. We have subscriptions to like the Chronicle and a number of like these LinkedIn learning spaces.
Yeah.
I give time for my staff to like, we call it pro-pack time. So in your own time, I just say like, you know, whatever you want to learn, you know, and then come back and like, you know, tell us, you know, how you can add. So I think that's how we are making do with our own professional development. But I think there's also this understanding that, you know, no one is holding like the money banks, right? Like the money bag, like there just isn't that kind of funding as we used to see in higher education, right? Like at least
10 years. We just were talking about this yesterday in our staff meeting. I mean, one thing I'm trying to do is find people who are really good at using AI in their work, whether it's work like mine or faculty who I know, and just sit with them, you know, I just want to look over your shoulder. It's like sitting next to a really good musician. I do this sometimes with a pianist who I've known forever. And I just say, stop. What was that? Harmonically, would you break that down for me? Just to see how they do what they do, and then take that and take the pieces that seem useful and try them out in our own space. And that's why it's great that we have at the University Gemini now, because people were using ChatGPT and this or that, and you don't want to put sensitive things in those tools because it's way out in the open, or your own work products that you might just, you're giving it away. So that's what I've been trying to do, is just sit and watch and listen to people who are doing it really well.
That's a very good lesson.
So, gentlemen, I talk a lot because, and plus Ken and I have known each other a long time, so it's easy to check up or check in and talk. Kenem, tell us about, let's get into the stuff. Like, what do you like to do outside of work? I know you do lots of good stuff, and you know you're busy with your kids, but what do you do? What are you doing these days?
So these days, what am I doing? My term has ended with the Council of Asian Pacific Minnesotans. Now I'm on the board for a school. It's a charter school in the Twin Cities called the Ocean of Wisdom School. It's a school supported by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And the whole framework is based on social emotional learning. So it's really kind of infusing the pedagogy of care from like very formative education. So I'm on the board and I've a lot of my energy is spent there attending board meetings, helping with grant writing. It's a super new school, so a lot of like programming related to that. So I'm been tied up with that.
But that's a lot. But I imagine it allows you to bring so much of your background, what you do now, what you've done, and to bear. You get to bring it all to the table.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, and I think a lot of my energy is sucked being a twin mom. But overall, I think, yeah, it's a lot of good things happening at MCAD. I think...
And you have a new president recently, if I saw
it. We have a wonderful president, Gwendolyn. She just came from the U, a musician, so someone who's familiar, you know, I'm saying the arts, right?
Yeah.
Everyone loves her. She's a very, very good listener. I think she deeply listens, very present with the community. So I've been hearing very good things. I personally have also felt good feelings.
So, well, and given that you have a new president, what have you, has your president shared their, priorities, or is that just something that you're kind of waiting to learn more about?
She has, She shared a priority, like, the moment I'm saying she did, like, the first time I met her in one of our cabinet meetings, she shared where it's in line with her predecessor, and again, reaffirming that we are a campus of care, reaffirming our values of diversity, equity, inclusion, right? And so we still continue to do, advance some of these ideas, right, or sustain in light of what's happening.
How is that going? I mean, Minnesota is its own place. I live here too, obviously. So, we're in the same metro area. How's it going? I mean, do you feel headwinds?
Yeah, I think it's actually, I'm liking the bubble, Fritz. Like, I'm liking the bubble. I don't want to read the news. I'm just joking. So I actually am really, I think like overall the community, it's a community of like inclusive practitioners. People all come from various backgrounds. We have a huge population of neurodivergent learners, trans, right? People who identify with all of these various identities. So, our institutionally, we are very supportive of these values. And I think even through the leadership top down to its, there is a strong commitment towards this. For example, I'm on the anti-oppression curriculum committee, which is still simmering. We just still to continue doing work there. We still have the DEIA committee.
I know you have the institution's been around a long time. You have a large alumni base.
Yeah.
Which I have no doubt is supportive, but you also, you're situated in the Minneapolis Twin Cities area where there's a huge arts and creative community. It's massive. Theater, music, arts, visual, performing arts. So, you're in the right place for that.
There's a lot of support. I agree. Yeah. Especially for artists, I think in terms of every artist that I've met, they say, I think the Twin Cities provides a lot of support in terms of.
I want to ask a question about how much, if at all, is the workforce Pell shift giving you all a tailwind, allowing opportunity for people, students, learners to come and take programming and get credentials from MCAD, you know, to give them the funding to do that. You said you have a very large Pell grant. Does that add another boost of potential students, current and active? I mean, people are coming because of it. Oh, great. I can get a Pell for this small certificate rather than having to be a bachelor's and above.
Oh, yeah. I think not in my role, but I think overall, like the college is conducting market studies, you know, as other institutions, looking at, you know, the viability of various programs, innovating various curriculums, or continuing to enhance programs, also kind of looking at like what the market looks like outside of the US market, right? We haven't tapped into the international market at all, you know, and so if you think about why go at MCAD? We just talked about it earlier, right? MCAD is small and mighty. It's been there for a long time. It has a deep tradition, right? A strong foundation, right? And so like, I think there's a lot of potential there. But again, there's also a bit of a fear, right? In terms of like fiscally, you know, how can you carry out some of these goals? To do all of this, you need money. And we are strapped as an institution, right, for money. And I think it also, this is something that's probably happening in higher education in terms of like, we really need to reimagine when we think about like donorship, because those days of like providing big grants, right, those days of like someone writing a check to the chemistry department is gone, you know, like,
It's a tougher hill.
Yeah, I don't think those days exist anymore. So I think like this idea of like, how do you sustain, right, an institution, right, fiscal, like I'm saying, how do you sustain, but while also like sustaining like the quality of its programs while not compromising on the quality of its programs, right? Because that's the anxiety and fear that stems like in our own college is while we want to innovate programs to be relevant, right, to make it more relevant for the job market, we're also dismissing programs, right, that exist, and people are losing their jobs, right, because their classes are not relevant. These adjunct instructors, you know. So there's a lot of equity also issues that pop up, right? So it's messy, it's complicated, but we still live in interesting times, I think, in higher ed, right? No doubt.
Yeah. What other questions do you guys want to get into?
I mean, I think as an online program, the opportunity to expand internationally, I think, is just interesting from where you sit, and that's a challenge versus maybe more of a strategic priority to try to figure that out faster. And then earlier, for some reason, I was on mute and you were talking about your graduates being successful, but also the what's happening in this space. And I made the comment to myself, everybody's also using AI and they're competing against your graduates in this space. And so now it's almost, I mean, literally, I created a cartoon character of the three of us through AI, right? Like using our photos and said, hey, make a cartoon. And it did it. Not great, but it did it. But you have that. So now you have, and I think probably many of your students in your programs are probably getting hit more with AI being able to generate cartoons and movies and a lot of the things. But at the same time, they could also be learning how to use AI to do that in their career as well, right? Like there's a positive and there's a negative to that. If I'm the self-funded artist and I want to do my drawings and I want to sell my drawings I'm competing against somebody who may be doing it the other way.
So I think that's a good point. And I think like the utility of the AI use should be considered, right? So if you are a student who's going into art school, the purpose of your art education is to kind of like build on your artistic identity, right? Which means you need to kind of really build on all of these skill sets. So there is very limited ways for you to kind of build on your artistic identity if you're in this regurgitation loop, right? Like, for example, like you're using this cartoon, you're not really delving, because in the creative process, right, the creative process, every innovation, if you look at, there's this period of ambivalence, right, and messiness that actually provides that insight, right?
Yeah. And that's what I was talking about before. You have to wrestle with it. And anything, you know.
Anything,
to be a good writer, to do research, you know, the qualitative research we all have done. And you have to struggle with it.
Like, remember Archimedes when he was in that bathtub?
And he sat down and displaced the water. And, oh, my God.
Yes. But I think like that's a miss with when you have this ease of, for example, right? I think this is where... I was reading this article a while back where, you know, the M-dash,
because
now the writing is just so like nice, right? That I actually find it like refreshing reading like wrong spelling or, you know, like mishmash words, because, you know, like someone actually like wrote it and was attentive. Rather than this long gobbledygook,
flowy prose that just
right of the same thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I think it's what you want, right? And I think as society, this is also like a reflection of our society, right? It's kind of like we were postmodern, like maybe 10 years ago. Now it's like postmodern. Like it's like absurdity. Like look at Sora, like this deep fake videos. And now the effects of that, like, I can't even imagine. Like, I don't even want to get into that space. But it's interesting, I would say.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's a good spot to pause. I mean, is there anything else you want to get to, Kenneth, that you would like to talk about with amongst it? We're four higher ed insiders.
Well, how are y'all? I guess I'm curious to learn, how are y'all approaching, I'm saying AI literacy and some of these issues centering, let's say, ethics, integrity, academic integrity, right? And also, like, because the tool is so disruptive, the technology, as like in your own roles, how are you also doing the educating, right? Because it's so like changing. So
educating of ourselves or people?
Of yourselves, of the people that you have to be doing, right? That's what we are finding challenging in our own areas. It's like, wow, it's just like.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, within the University of Texas system, I think the campuses, are grappling with all of that. Some campuses, though, are actually developing, you know, professional development opportunities for faculty and staff to just learn more about what AI is and to cover these bigger topics around the ethical use of it. I know at the system level, we're also kind of struggling with, like, right now, you know, we are being told not to, as Fritz mentioned earlier, not to use other, like to use ChatGPT for something super sensitive, right? So, you know, we're kind of being corralled to use, because we're more of a Microsoft shop, you know, using, you know, the tools there, you know, within Microsoft's Copilot. But you know, I just got invited to a pilot where, you know, I'll be able to actually like use some of the more advanced features, like test those out. So I think we're definitely not putting our head in the sand, but I think we are kind of treading cautiously so that we can share out with each other what's working, you know, what's not working with some of the tools that we're using.
So, yeah, there's similar things going at the University of Minnesota. And part of it is that the speed of AI, its development, its diffusion, bumped into or slammed into, whatever you want to call it, the normal rhythm of the University of Minnesota. So we recently, we have a new-ish president, as I like to say. We have a brand new provost who started this summer. And we just yesterday put out the framework for the strategic plan that's being, that has been under development for quite a while now, mm-hmm. since the new president arrived, and the other one was done in 2025. So no one has really wanted to push, really put the pedal down on AI, developing AI competencies around the university, because what if when one of these new people arrived, when the strategic plan totally shifted where it was going? So there's been a treading in water and wait, I think a reasonable wait and see, because we want to, you know, we want to march forward with purpose that and aligns with the strategic plan that just came out. So now that we have that, now that we've just implemented Gemini, I mean, so one of the things we're doing is since I manage our Coursera relationship for the university, we have some Gemini and Google Gemini AI essentials learning materials in there that we have access to. So our, the units that do staff and faculty development, they're figuring out how to deploy this to the masses at the university. So there will be those efforts, but it's just, get through a couple of gates first, but now I think we're going to start moving forward with that because we really need to.
Worst, wait and learn. I mean, it's the same. I don't think there's a direct path to where we're going with AI, but I also don't think we're resistant to it. I think it's just, we've all got to figure out how it fits into all of our different places.
Especially not unlike
academically, I think is the biggest challenge.
Yeah.
So, I mean, for me, I would rather see AI. How can we use AI in student success? How can we use AI in our marketing recruiting? How can we use, more chatbots probably, or more just predictive analysis, things that will help us do things better. I'm less concerned about whether or not somebody didn't write their paper.
True. There's different uses. There's different utilities.
That can happen anyways.
Yeah, there's different utilities for this, for the tool. Absolutely. So, Fritz, going back to your, like with the you, do you think like overall in general, the people felt a lot more confidence with like doing AI literacy, like after there was like a strong positioning on like
Gemini?
Now, through your strategic plan, you mentioned about the strategic plan.
As it relates to AI, I don't know yet. I mean, for our office, what we've been looking for is signals, and we've been part of the process too, is what does this mean for us and where we're going with online and distributed programs? How will we be involved, or what's the plan essentially? Where are we going? Where's the horizon? So then now we can figure out how we get to that destination. So, but I've all the confidence that there are people thinking about this from an AI perspective, but honestly, I haven't been, it's not my bailiwick, so I don't dig into it all the time. I just want to use it really well in what I do to amplify it, speed up effectively what I do. Totally. So I can actually, it scales me. I want to scale me, and we want to scale our office without having to grow our FTE a bunch to get there.
Yeah, I'm saying all of those are useful, right? Like a little assistant, mini assistant that you can check, but it's not checking for you. Check in, right?
Well, I think this is a natural place for us to leave it. You know, the big question of what's AI going to do to our world of higher education and our roles. So, Kendam, thank you so much for joining us. It's great to see you. I owe you a visit at MCAD, and we need to go to Eat Street sometime.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Come to check out some art.
Yeah, I would love that. So, thank you again. Have a great weekend and all the best.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. Nice to talk to you, Gavin and Kelvin.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.